You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Here's a question for you. Should race be a factor when it comes to getting into college? It is a question that you and other California voters will decide this election. And both sides of the issue are formulating their arguments.
Being a UC student, being a woman of, you know, a Black woman, and personally, I think it's kind of insulting and racist to lower the standards for people based on the color of their skin.
Callie Fontanilla is a high school teacher. She's against Proposition 16. Community college student Catherine Squire supports the ballot initiative to bring back affirmative action.
There's also just a certain set of obstacles that come with being a minority student that doesn't necessarily get recognized in the admissions process. What Prop 16 is really trying to get at is to just have race be considered a factor amongst income and amongst all these other factors that are already considered.
Now, the proposition would allow the state of California to look at someone's race or sex or color, ethnicity, or national origin when making decisions about things such as admissions to public universities, employment with state government, or awarding state government contracts. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb has been covering the story for us, and he's here now with a proposition primer. Hey, Benjamin.
Hello, Steve.
California used to allow affirmative action for state schools and jobs, but that was up until about the mid-1990s when voters took up this very same issue in Proposition 209. What are arguments in favor of bringing affirmative action back, in essence, nullifying Proposition 209 that was passed, more than 20 years ago?
Sure. If you believe something like race should be a factor in getting into, well, let's just use the University of California, for example, then you would be in favor of this proposition, Proposition 16. Affirmative action, Steve, is basically an acknowledgement of past practices that discriminated against certain groups or individuals, and it's one idea, this is, of how to remedy that. One of the proponents of this current ballot initiative, Proposition 16, is a man named Vincent Pan. He's the executive director of Chinese for Affirmative Action. It's a self-described progressive organization.
The ban on affirmative action in California has really held back women and people of color in the largest and most diverse state in the country. And when you understand how structural racism and systemic discrimination work, you understand that race-conscious, gender-conscious programs are critical.
So you have those systemic issues, but there's also what's happening on the ground right now. Catherine Squire, who we heard from in the introduction to this issue, she identifies as Latinx, she's a female student, and she comes from a lower income household in Stockton. And she believes that's why she couldn't get into any of the UC schools she applied to.
You know, for me, I went through the process of applying to, I think, about 5 UCs, and I ended up getting rejected by all of them with a 4.0. So I was really surprised. College admissions, always consider AP scores and how many AP classes you've taken and how well you've done. Well, for someone like me who lives in a very low-income area, especially in a city like Stockton, you know, I didn't have those opportunities to take AP classes and to even have a chance at being successful at those. And so, you know, here are college admissions kind of judging me based on classes that I haven't had the opportunity to take.
AP classes, of course, are referring to advanced placement classes. You can take them in high school, and they're a way to raise your GPA above that 4.0. Now, Squire is currently a student at San Joaquin Delta Community College, and both she and Pan believe that because of the disadvantages, both caused by past policies and those that exist today, it's proper for California's public institutions, such as the UC, to consider things like race when looking at admissions. If Squire can't take an AP class, for example, because of her socioeconomic background, her race, then that should, she says, the argument goes, be considered when she's up against other students who have that type of access.
Who do have that kind of access. And I wonder, Benjamin, these arguments are all in the interest of diversity, right?
Yeah, that's really important to point out because proponents will say, and they'll say rightfully, that the UC's admissions really don't represent the diverse nature of California and its overall demographics. I mean, if you look at Latino enrollment in the UC, that's actually gone up this year, the 2020 class, but I crunched the numbers for 2019, and it was just around 22% of the total student body. That includes both undergrads and graduate students who identify as Latino. But we know, Steve, that the total Latino population of California is way above that, almost 40%. Now, looking at history, it used to be the UC more representative. When California got rid of affirmative action, those numbers actually slipped. White and Asian students are overrepresented in the UC system, and that has been true since affirmative action was banned.
Banned back in the 1990s, again with Proposition 209. With all that in mind, Benjamin, what is the perspective of the opponents, the against side? The people say, wait a second, we voted on this once before. We don't need affirmative action.
Yeah, there are two main arguments that I want to highlight. The first one is best explained by Kylie Fontanilla. She's the teacher we heard from at the beginning. She teaches ESL at a high school in Salinas. That's English as a second language. She's also a UC graduate herself and a Black woman, and her argument is that affirmative action tells students of color that it's okay not to be as good as other students.
My whole life, I've really fought hard to get where I'm at, and to say that I need the standards lowered to get where someone else of a different color skin can get is just, it's insulting. Like, I can rise to the standard, and I've seen that over and over again with my students.
Now, the other argument is that affirmative action basically takes a spot at, say, UCLA or UC Santa Barbara away from another student because they are not a certain race or ethnicity.
At the margin, if you tip the scales against me because of my race, you have excluded me just as much as if there was a quota.
That's Tom Campbell. He made that argument back in the 1990s and is making it again today. Campbell is a former Republican California state senator who was involved with Proposition 209. This is the original ballot initiative that banned affirmative action back when it passed in the 1990s.
And I know, I think, and certainly compassion for many of the arguments on the other side, but doesn't change the fundamental unfairness to that one individual who was told your race is why you are not getting into the University of California.
I should point out, Campbell is now part of a political party called the Common Sense Party. He broke away from the Republican Party after President Trump's election, somewhat emblematic of how the Republican Party in California is on the downward trend in terms of membership. Now, Campbell says he believes more does need to be done to help disadvantaged communities, but not at the expense of others.
All right, so you say more needs to be done, but the judicial system has a say in all of this, right? I mean, the issue in some form or another has gone all the way to the United States Supreme Court. Is this even constitutional?
Such a good question. Somewhat of a complicated answer. You're definitely right. The judicial system has weighed in on this, and it has put a ban on any quotas. In other words, you can't say as a public institution, I want X number of Latino students, X number of Black students, X number of white students. That's unconstitutional. But the court did leave open the possibility of considering race in admissions and awarding public contracts if it's for a very specific goal. Now, in the case of the UC, Stephen Rich believes that affirmative action would survive legal scrutiny. Stephen teaches law at USC and is sort of an expert on affirmative action. And here's a little bit of his reason why.
It's not attempting to eradicate federal law. It's not saying that you have a constitutional right under the state to be awarded a spot within a school because of your race. Instead, it's putting the responsibility back upon state actors to craft affirmative action policies if they wish to, which are consistent with federal law.
Federal law here, Steve, is the 14th Amendment and its Equal Protection Clause. And you heard right there Stephen saying that he does believe that if this was passed by the voters, it would survive legal scrutiny. Now, I should point out, just because we have passed rulings, even from the Supreme Court, about this issue, does not mean things can't change. I mean, we know the makeup of the high court is in flux. It's shifting to the right. We'll have to see what happens with President Trump's most recent appointments. But this measure, Proposition 16, if passed, I am told, will still likely face a court challenge.
Well, before we get there, we need to see if voters will approve Prop 16. Obviously, that's on the ballot for November 3rd and before, with early voting going on as well. There are a number of big ticket down ballot items this election. We'll continue to cover those issues as well right here on Greater LA. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb. Benjamin, thank you.
Anytime.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with KCRW's Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you thought Tuesday night felt like sport, or whatever that was, on the debate stage, then welcome to Wednesday night. The Lakers and the Dodgers are headed into their respective playoffs. They're going to be playing around the same time this evening. The Lakers playing the Heat in the NBA Finals right at this moment. The Dodgers are going head-to-head with the Milwaukee Brewers starting in just a few minutes. To talk about these two games, Matthew Moreno is here. He's managing editor of Dodger Blue and Lakers Nation. Hey, Matthew.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. And Tanya Ganguly is also here. She covers the Lakers for the LA Times, and she's just outside the bubble in Central Florida, in Orlando. Hey, Tanya.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. I want to start with you, Tanya, since the Lakers are teeing off first. What can we expect tonight against the Heat?
Well, I think you can expect kind of what you've seen from the Lakers throughout this. I mean, they're going to use their size and their length against a team that has really thrived with Bam Adebayo, their young center. And the Lakers are going to try to kind of assert their dominance in the way that they have been throughout these playoffs. They're not the greatest jump shooting team, and I think that's what the Heat will rely on and try to work with defensively. But they have a lot of other ways that they can dominate opponents, and LeBron James and Anthony Davis are at the center of that. So I think you'll see that playing out starting tonight.
Let's talk about LeBron James, who played on the Heat, obviously, for years after he left Cleveland and before he went back to Cleveland. How's he going to factor in this game?
Yeah, I think for LeBron James, I think this is really more about what he's been trying to accomplish since he got to LA, to show people that he didn't come here to make movies and he didn't come here to just enjoy life in LA. He came here to win a championship with the Lakers.
And the Lakers have struggled, I mean, big time over the past, gosh, almost a decade, right?
Sure. They missed the playoffs 6 years in a row, which was unprecedented for the organization. They haven't been to the finals in 10 years, which we all like to talk about as such a long drought. But there's so many other teams in the NBA that would love it if they could make the finals every 10 years. But for the Lakers, that's an expectation. And, you know, LeBron wanted to be part of making that the expectation again. And this year he has been able to do that.
Matthew, I want to bring you in. Talk about the Dodgers, who have the home field advantage in these playoffs. What should we expect for their game tonight against the Brewers?
Yeah, so, you know, I think it's going to be interesting. Obviously, the Dodgers decided to go with Walker Buehler in game one over Clayton Kershaw, just like they did last year. I think the difference being now is, you know, with Walker, he's coming off. He's had some blister trouble. In September, he was on the 10-day injured list. He and the team have both said that it's not an issue anymore. But, you know, that with blisters, the Dodgers have plenty of experience with this. With Rich Hill, it could kind of pop up at any time. I think that's something to watch with them. And on the other side, with the Brewers, it's going to be similar to when the Dodgers played them in 2018 in the NLCS, where they're probably going to lean pretty heavily on their bullpen. If the Dodgers can, you know, take an early lead, I think it will bode well for them. If not, you know, it could get a little interesting. And this year, with the expanded postseason, the wild card series being a best of three, you know, the first game carries even more weight than it normally would.
Right. We've had an abridged season, obviously, the wild card going on now. What happens if the Dodgers do muster, you know, two wins out of this and move on? Where do they go next?
then it would be off to Texas and a bubble there, and they'd be playing at Globe Life Field, and they would await the winner of the Padres and the Cardinals. And, you know, I think most people over the past few weeks have been looking at it as the Dodgers and Padres sort of being on a collision course. Of course, now the Padres are dealing with some injuries to Mike Clevinger and Dinelson Lamet, who both were left off their wildcard series roster. So that, I think, changes the outlook a little bit for not only the first round, but their availability moving forward.
Tanya, the fact that it was, you know, the season was interrupted by the pandemic. This has been going on in the bubble. You just heard Matthew talking about this bubble in Texas that, you know, there aren't fans in the stands. This is such a weird year. How does that, and by the way, you know, we talked about the drought that the Lakers have had. I mean, how does that factor into the playoff psyche, you know, for these players who are trying to get ready for something like this? Are they looking at this year differently, or are they just, we just want to play ball and we want to win it all?
Yeah, it's very different. I mean, they've been stuck in Orlando since the middle of July. And that's never something that they've never experienced before. They have their family, some family members in here now that have been here for a few weeks, but LeBron James hasn't seen his kids in 3 months. And that's very unusual for him. And it's difficult for them. And they've all talked about how this is the most difficult. They believe this is the most difficult playoff run that has ever been, because of these circumstances. And it also makes it a little hard to predict. I mean, there are no fans in the stands. So everyone wondered, the Heat won their first two games against the Milwaukee Bucks. Those would have been home games for the Bucks, and the Bucks worked hard all season to earn those home games. Would they have gone that way if they were in Milwaukee? I don't think we know the answer to that. So that creates a whole different dynamic between these teams and for these teams.
Matthew, a little different, though, for the Dodgers. They've been playing at the stadium, although a shortened season, of course, in front of cardboard cutouts, one of which is mine. So, I mean, you know, it seems like baseball has gone on, kind of, without fans in the stands. Any different in this playoff than in other years that the Dodgers have made it?
Yeah, I think more so than not having fans from a baseball's perspective is a team like the Dodgers, who won their division, finished with the best record in the National, in all of baseball, and there isn't really any true advantage that comes with it. You know, sure, they're getting to host the entire wildcard series at Dodger Stadium, but so are the top four teams in each league. And now you're playing, you know, a best of three series in the first round, whereas in years past, if you've been in the Dodgers position, you're awaiting a winner from the wildcard game. And then, you know, you go straight into the NLDS, where it's a best of five, and in theory, you know, the quote unquote best team typically wins in series like that. So, you know, I think players have adjusted to not having fans. You know, the music and kind of in-game entertainment has helped. I think the biggest thing is, like I said, just not having any sort of real home field advantage or benefit.
A lot of channel surfing tonight, too, going back and forth, or people who have a couple of TVs side by side, because there's going to be a lot of that going on. Matthew Moreno, managing editor of Dodger Blue and Lakers Nation, and Tanya Ganguly, who covers the Lakers for the LA Times. Fingers crossed for both teams. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Finally today, a history lesson. It seems like you can't go an hour during the day without hearing calls for racial justice, hearing the names of Black Americans killed or brutalized at the hands of police. Add to that a president who stokes the flames on the regular, the most recent example at last night's presidential debate. We are a nation with a history deeply rooted in its original sin and whose ugly remnants to this day drive the news cycle. So let's take a moment to remember a trailblazer here in California who, against crazy odds, fought and won in an effort to make a difference. I was looking at this piece the other day at the California Sun about a man named Frederick Roberts. He was the first Black American to serve in the California legislature. In 1918, more than 100 years ago, he ran for state assembly. And even during a time of deep hostility for Black people, he won. He served for four terms in the assembly and became known as the dean there for his decorum and bipartisanship. In his family lineage alone, Roberts exemplified a complicated America. Yet he also serves as an example of someone who moved the needle in a positive direction for all Black Americans. Susan Anderson is history curator at the California African American Museum here in Los Angeles, and she's with us right now. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Frederick Roberts had quite the family history, right? Can you explain that?
Well, his name was Frederick Madison Roberts, and his middle name, Madison, was taken from his grandfather, who was the son of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings have hundreds of descendants that are still around throughout the United States. And Frederick Roberts' family also is still around in California and other parts of the West.
Let's be clear, of course, Thomas Jefferson, one of the founding fathers, Sally Hemings, his slave.
That's right. This was a liaison that was well known in the country from the time that Jefferson was in office in the 18th century through the 20th century. African Americans were aware of this lineage. People who were in the family, certainly the descendants of Jefferson and Hemings, were aware of the lineage. It was white historians and sort of keepers of the history that denied what has now been proven with evidence. And if people are interested in this history, there's wonderful information that the society that preserves the history of Thomas Jefferson and Monticello, his mansion in Virginia, the Monticello Foundation has been one of the best sources of information about the descendants of Jefferson and Hemings. And Frederick Roberts was part of the Western branch of that family in the U.S.
Western branch, it was in California. 1918 was a tough time. Obviously, there was another pandemic, a flu pandemic, a war that had enveloped much of the world. It was wrapping up by 1918. What was his campaign like, Susan, at a time in America that was not only systemically, but overtly racist?
Well, I think that it's important to look at a hidden history of California and African Americans who've been in California since before the gold rush. Frederick Roberts was a leader in the community. He was a well-known figure. He published a newspaper, The New Age. He inherited a mortuary business that his father and some business partners established in Los Angeles. He was better off than most residents, no matter what their color was in Los Angeles, and he had great standing. He also, when he ran for office in what was then the 74th Assembly District, it became the 62nd Assembly District, he ran in a district that was majority white, and he actually set the standard for African-American elected officials who won political office, because in later generations, we saw a similar phenomenon where someone in a majority white district would win office. That certainly was the case when Tom Bradley ran for the 10th Councilmanic District and helped break the color line on the city council. Tom Bradley won in a district that was one-third African-American residents. So when Roberts ran in 1918, it's clear that this was a person who had a great deal of optimism, high expectations. He was able to build probably the first multi-ethnic political coalition in Los Angeles history by putting together Republicans, white and black Republicans, progressive party members, and others who brought him to victory in that first assembly race in 1918.
Of course, the Republicans and Democrats are a little different today than they were in 1918, but you could say that Roberts...
Well, Roberts was what people called a Lincoln Republican. And from the time the Republican Party was founded as a party that opposed the expansion of slavery outside of the South, African Americans gave their political loyalty and their votes in large numbers and in a majority to the Republican Party. That, of course, changed as the Republican Party changed and as the Democratic Party changed in the 20th century. And as a matter of fact, Roberts was finally beaten in during the height of the Depression by a young Black politician, Augustus Hawkins, who put together a kind of New Deal, New Democratic coalition to beat Roberts, who remained a Republican through his death in 1952.
He served four terms, though, before he was defeated. What was the rest of his life like? You said he remained a Republican. How did he try to make a difference in the years following his time in Sacramento?
Well, that's a great question, because he's responsible for important legislation. He was a crusader against lynching. He authored legislation in Sacramento that made school textbooks more available to public school students. He helped update the state's civil rights laws. He helped found the Los Angeles branch of the NAACP. He was on the board of the YWCA. He was a trustee at First AME Church. His family was culturally active. His wife, Pearl Hines, who was from Oakland and Tulare County, was a classical pianist and a music teacher. And I think looking at their family life, the business life, and his civic life, that it was a very, very full existence. His contributions to the community were manifold.
How can people, Susan, of all colors, look at Frederick Roberts as example today, do you think? I mean, what can you take from his life story that maybe will move the needle even further in today's terms? Because we're in quite a time these days.
Well, I think that one lesson is the obvious hope and optimism that helped guide him to even run for political office in 1918 in the first place. So that's one thing I think we can look at, because it looks on the face of it that there was everything against him. But clearly, he had a point of view and an approach to life that was far more optimistic and had very high expectations. And he was able to actually live up to those. The other lesson I think that's important is that he developed a model for working together across lines of class, across racial lines, by putting together a coalition of voters in a district that was majority white to win office as the first Black legislature. I want to say, too, that he was not the first Black man in Los Angeles to run for political office. For years, Black people had been running for the city council, running for other offices. So this accumulated effort ended up being successful in his case. And he clearly opened the door to the legislature and to other political office for others to walk through that door and take their rightful place in these elected bodies.
Susan Anderson, history curator at the California African American Museum. Susan, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
By the way, if you found that story about Frederick Roberts interesting, you can hear my full conversation with Susan at our website, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Want to take the show to go? You don't need no stinking radio, although we do love radio. We love it. Join a lot of your friends and neighbors who are subscribing to the podcast. Yes, it is a podcast too, and you can listen anytime you want. You can also tell us what you think, how you're doing. Maybe you need a hand to hold. We're here for you at kcrw.com/greaterLA. That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, go to the heart of a conflict between church and state, the local church that's testing the limits of government power. That's tomorrow. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Kat Yore, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen today. I'm Steve Chiatakis. You made the show happen too. Thanks for listening and for your ears. Have a great night.